is the news.
The Iranian army is holding military exercises in an area stretching from the eastern part of the strategic Strait of Hormuz to the northern tip of the Indian Ocean. Tehran slams anti-Iran provisions of the U.S. National Defense Authorization Act, saying they are aimed at stoking Iranophobia. Also in the headlines, a court in Myanmar has convinced the country deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi on corruption charges and sentenced her to 7 years in prison. Good to have you with us. Our top story, the Iranian Army's Navy has staged a large-scale military exercise in the Oman Sea and the north of the Indian Ocean. The drills are aimed at testing indigenously built military equipment and enhancing the country's preparedness against potential threats. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The Iranian Army repels American vessels trying to violate Iran's southern waters. This is one of the scenarios of the first phase of a massive naval drill staged by the Iranian Army's Navy. Codenamed Zulfaghar, the maneuver is conducted over an area stretching from the Persian Gulf Strait of Hormuz to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The large-scale Zulfaghar maneuver is underway with the goal of integrating our network of armed forces and testing our naval defense capabilities. In this drill, we have carried out different defensive and offensive operations using our own domestically developed military equipment.
The drill involved all of the four branches of the Iranian army in 3 days of exercises. On the first day, the Navy conducted beaching or amphibious operations, which involved Marines in an operation ashore aimed at assaulting the enemy's coastal units.
Beaching an amphibious operation is an Iranian initiative which has long been adopted by different navies around the world. It's an effective way of breaking into the enemy's coast. Beaching has advanced over time according to the advances in the hardware, but the idea and the way it's implemented remains the same.
The first phase of the maneuver saw the use of the latest hardware built domestically by the Iranian armed forces, including surveillance and reconnaissance drones such as Ababil 3 and Mohajer 6, which can also conduct tactical and combat missions. The drill also involved the use of surface-to-surface missiles such as Dehlaviyeh guided missile to protect the Iranian beach against the enemy's amphibious operations. The Iranian Navy says this is a routine drill which is staged every year to boost its naval force and fine-tune its homegrown military equipment. It says using its weapons, it is now fully prepared to confront any threat to Iran's territorial waters. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
Tehran has blasted anti-Iran provisions of the U.S. National Defense Authorization Act, signed into law by President Joe Biden. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the provisions reflect the continuation of Washington's hostile, provocative, and meddlesome policies against Iran. Kanani said they are also aimed at stoking Iranophobia and promoting a propaganda campaign against the Islamic Republic. He pointed to Washington's false allegations against Tehran's peaceful nuclear program specified in the Defense Authorization Act. Kanani said it was the U.S. that violated the international law by pulling out of the 2015 nuclear deal, adding the accusations will not legitimize Washington's illegal sanctions against Tehran. The National Defense Authorization Act, signed into law last week, accuses Iran of a lack of transparency with the International Atomic Energy Agency and vows to combat what it describes as Iran's aggression. Political analyst Alexander Azadegan says Washington's accusations against Tehran are baseless because Iran's nuclear program has gone through the most rigorous inspections by the IAEA.
The NDAA accused Iran of the lack of transparency with the IAEA. This is completely false. Up until 2018 and a little further than that, IAEA itself admitted over 10 consecutive visits of Iran's nuclear site, minus Fordo, and verified Iran's full compliance. Of course, things have changed during the past couple of years, but it was Trump who kickstarted and even further created a spirit of distrust. This is a fact, not conjecture. But what exactly, our audience may be interested to know, what exactly is the NDAA? What does it consist of? Section 1245 of the NDAA requires the president to block the property and interest subject to U.S. jurisdiction of all financial institutions of Iran, including the CBI, Central Bank of Iran. It also aims to reduce the Iranian oil revenues and discourage transactions with the CBI by providing sanctions on all foreign financial institutions that knowingly conduct or facilitate certain significant financial transactions with CBI.
On December 30, 2009, nationwide pro-establishment rallies in Iran put an end to foreign-backed post-election riots. And every year, on this day, people turn out in different cities, particularly the capital, Tehran, to commemorate what they describe as the epic rallies that dealt the final blow to all who were instigating riots in the country. Gisu Misha Ahmadi tells us more.
Thousands turned out on Thursday to commemorate the 13th anniversary of the 2009 nationwide rallies that put an end to the post-election unrest back then and also renewed their allegiance to the Islamic establishment. I want to tell the whole world that even if all our enemies unite to defeat us, we will all defend our leader and our country.
I have two messages, one for our enemies and one for our people. To the enemies, I say, you cannot promote an anti-hijab culture in Iran. And to our people, I say, we should remain vigilant regarding the enemy's plots against the Islamic Republic.
The demonstrators also denounced any act of violence and sabotage by foreign-backed rioters against the Islamic Republic.
Anyone who believes in God and holds onto that belief will eventually be rewarded by God. This verse of the Holy Quran applies to the situation we're in today, so it's very important to show our full support for the leader.
According to a statement read at the end of the rallies, Iranians will not tolerate any acts of sabotage that would jeopardize the security and territorial integrity of the country.
I have been taking part in popular demonstrations because it's very important to keep the memory of our martyrs alive, all those who lost their lives so that we can live in a peaceful environment and an independent country.
We are here to pledge allegiance to the leader and to commemorate the rallies that put an end to the foreign-backed riots 13 years ago. We are here to say that we will support Ayatollah Khamenei till the last drop of our blood.
The occasion, dubbed the Ninth of Day Epic, refers to the huge demonstrations held in Tehran and other cities across Iran on the ninth of the month of Day in the Persian calendar, which falls on December 30th, in support of the Islamic Republic. The rallies restored calm in the country and put an end to the post-election unrest, and therefore every year Iranians mark the occasion by taking part in nationwide demonstrations.
More than anything, this is a show of solidarity. People have turned out in the capital, Tehran, to show their support for leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, and also to show that they are as vigilant as they were back in 2009. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Now, the number of Israeli settlers storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied West Bank hit a record in 2022. This is according to the Islamic Waqf department that runs the holy site. The department's director said nearly 50,000 fanatic settlers stormed the compound and violated its sanctity during 2022. Azim Khatib said the figure represents the highest ever number of violations of the mosque's compound in the occupied East Al-Quds. He added that Israeli settlers hurt Muslim sentiments by performing Jewish rituals and raising the Israeli flag inside the compound during their holidays. The official also warned that the regime's new right-wing cabinet might make moves that could trigger a religious war in the region and the world. Twitter CEO has revealed that all social media platforms work with the U.S. government to censor content. Elon Musk released documents following his purchase of Twitter. The documents show the social media platform conspired with the FBI, CIA, Pentagon, and other government agencies to suppress information on U.S. elections, the issue of Ukraine, the COVID-19 pandemic, among other matters.
The United States has always prided itself as a country that protects freedom of speech. However, there are mounting evidence that when it comes to freedom of speech in social media platforms, the government of the US is bending the rules in its favor to suppress narratives that it does not like. Twitter CEO Elon Musk has accused the U.S. government of pushing all social media platforms work with the U.S. government to censor content. According to Musk, every social media company is engaged in heavy censorship with significant involvement and at times explicit direction of the government. Musk was referring to internal Twitter communications published by journalist Matt Taibbi with his approval. The files showed the FBI acting as doorman to a vast program of social media surveillance and censorship, encompassing agencies across the federal government. Musk released documents following his purchase of Twitter. According to Taibbi, in addition to Twitter, the U.S. government was in contact with virtually every major tech firm, which included Facebook, Microsoft, Verizon, Reddit, and even Pinterest. According to the document, CIA agents nearly always sat in meetings of these firms with the FBI's Foreign Influence Task Force. The firms reportedly colluded with the FBI to remove content the agency wanted hidden, assisted the U.S. military's online influence campaigns, and censored, quote, anti-Ukraine narratives on behalf of multiple U.S. intelligence agencies.
I think a lot of people have questions. How involved is the government in monitoring and censoring the speech of ordinary people? What we've seen so far already, and we have definite conclusive proof of, is that there are lots and lots of reports where we see Twitter executives saying things like, DHS flagged this, the FBI flagged this, and then there's a whole thread where they decide what to do about it. Do we remove it? Do we put a label on it? So there's tons of that stuff where they're clearly getting communications from the FBI.
Well, earlier this month, it was also revealed that the U.S. military uses Twitter to amplify its propaganda campaigns in West Asia. And Twitter reportedly allowed the CENTCOM to run fake accounts. Furthermore, it's believed that the U.S. government reportedly pressured social media platforms to shape online discourse.
Earlier this month, it was revealed that Twitter helped the US military amplify its propaganda campaigns in the West Asia region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-US narratives. Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by US Central Command or CENTCOM from spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts. The findings of this research appear to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation were spreading misinformation. And earlier this year, it was revealed that the US government made efforts to influence cyberspace in the country through a cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency.
We also know that they have meetings, not just with the FBI, and the DHS, but also a surprise was the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. I hadn't heard that before. That was a new one. And then we're learning a lot about the kind of scraping of raw intelligence and fire hosing it to the government, all kinds of government agencies on the back end. So the government is harvesting tons of information from these companies and then all turning around and spitting it back to companies like Twitter in the form of requests for, you know, maybe bannings, maybe shadow bans, maybe deletions or labels and that sort of thing. It's fascinating.
The U.S. government reportedly pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. There are now concerns that officials in the Department for Homeland Security have greater influence to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. And critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
Now, let's carry on with another news item. A court in the junta ruled Myanmar finds ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi guilty on 5 counts of corruption. The court has ordered Suu Kyi to serve 7 more years in jail. The offences are related to her lease and use of a helicopter while she was Myanmar's de facto leader. The latest court ruling wraps up the remaining cases against her. Suu Kyi's new verdict adds to sentences of at least 26 years, which ranged from corruption to illegally owning radio equipment. The former leader has denied all charges against her. Last week, the UN Security Council adopted the first ever resolution on Myanmar that called on the military junta to release all political prisoners. The Myanmar's military seized power in February last year of alleged voter fraud during the 2020 elections. That brings an end to our World Bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
Special live coverage for the start of New Year 2023 on Saturday, December 31st at 7:30 p.m. Tehran time, 1600 GMT.
فهل من مدكر.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today we complete explanation of the remaining part of Surah Saf, which declares God's love of all those believers who maintain the solid ranks of unity in selflessly and fearlessly defending Islam. It encourages the believers to stick together in support of God's cause and criticizes those who broke the word and those who argued against the faith. Moses and Jesus are among the prophets whose communities became fragmented. The rebellious were left to go astray and the faithful granted success. We start from where we left you last week. And here are ayahs 10, 11, 12, and 13 of the same surah.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا هَلْ أَدُلُّكُمْ عَلَى تِجَارَةٍ تُنْجِيكُمْ مِنْ عَذَابٍ أَلِيمٍ تؤمنون بالله ورسوله وتجاهدون في سبيل الله بأموالكم وأنفسكم ذلكم خير لكم إن كنتم تعلمون يغفر لكم ذنوبكم ويدخلكم جنات تجري من تحتها الأنهار ومساكن طيبة في جنات عدن ذلك الفوز العظيم وأخرى تحبونها نصر من الله وفتح قريب وبشر المؤمنين.
O you who have faith, shall I show you a deal that will deliver you from a painful punishment? Have faith in Allah and His Prophet and wage jihad in the way of Allah with your possessions and persons. That is better for you, should you know. We will forgive you your sins and admit you into gardens with streams running in them, and into good dwellings in the gardens of Eden. That is the great success. And other blessings you love, help from Allah and a victory near at hand, and give good news to the faithful. Remember, last week in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said that in spite of the aversion of the disbelievers, the light of guidance of Islam is all set to triumph over all other religions and schools of thought. This will happen with the reappearance in the end times of the Prophet's 12th and last infallible heir, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, who will end corruption on earth and establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. The ayahs that we recited to you now give good tidings to the firm of faith of God's mercy and immunity from punishment of those who sincerely strive in his path through seeking of forgiveness of faults and sins, even at risk of life and possessions. Ayahs 12 and 13 mean to say that for such persons of firm faith, forgiveness of faults is followed by the reward of paradise, an entry into its lush green gardens in which fresh streams flow, flanked by beautiful dwellings. This is indeed a great success, prior to which our tidings of material triumph in the mortal life of the transient world as well. With the help of God Almighty, of which the faithful ought to be informed. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, we should not be despaired of divine mercy, since the doors of forgiveness are always open for those repentance and those who reform themselves. Number two, rewards for those who selflessly and sincerely strive in the way of God, even if their life and possessions are at risk, are not limited to worldly life, and have the greater benefit of paradise in the hereafter. And number three, a person of firm faith in the monotheism of God and the teachings of the prophet neither hesitates to sacrifice his possessions, nor is afraid of attaining martyrdom. Conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we present you Ayah 14 of Surah Saf.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu kunu ansar Allah kama qala Isa ibn Maryam lil hawariyin man ansari ila Allah qala al hawariyun nahnu ansaru Allah faamana ta'ifatun min bani Isra'ila wa kafara ta'ifa فَأَيَّدْنَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا عَلَىٰ عَدُوِّهِمْ فَأَصْبَحُوا ظَاهِرِينَ
O you who have faith, be Ansarullah, Allah's helpers, just as Jesus, son of Mary, said to the disciples, who will be my helpers for Allah's sake? The disciples said, we will be Ansarullah, Allah's helpers. So a group of the children of Israel believed and a group disbelieved. Then we strengthened the faithful against their enemies and they became the dominant ones. This ayah calls on the true believers to rise to the position of Ansarullah or the helpers of Allah, similar to the lofty status attained by the chosen disciples of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him. It is obvious the Almighty's Creator is not in need of any helper. And here, by asking for help for the Prophet and religion, the believers undergo a practical test to prove their claim to faith, Thus, a believer becomes a helper of God through efforts to defend the creed by promoting Islam via various positive methods and at the same time recognizing and confronting the plots of the enemies of humanity. The ayah then points to the call of Prophet Jesus to his 12 chosen disciples to be Ansarullah, or the helpers of God, and their answer in the affirmative, which made some of the Israelites to believe in their mission, and others to reject them. Later, some of them stopped helping and in fear of their life, joined the enemies. God, however, strengthened the true believers against the enemies and made them the dominant group. Here, it is worth referring to an interesting statement from the Prophet of Islam's 6th infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, who has said, "Our followers are our disciples. Some of the disciples of Jesus has failed to bear him assistance against the enemies and the Jews, but our followers render us help. They're tortured, sent into exile, or they fall martyrs in our cause. God Almighty will grant them excellent rewards in exchange for so many afflictions that they tolerate for our sake." This ayah teaches us that, number one, having faith is not enough, and the faithful should practically do his or her best to safeguard and promote the true creed. Number two, if we strive in the way of God, we rise to the position of being helpful. And certainly, the Almighty Creator, who has no need of any helper, will help us overcome the enemies of humanity. And number three, in every age and place, the true believers have sacrificed their possessions and attained martyrdom in defense of the genuine teachings of Islam. Well, dear friends, on this note, we come to the end of Surah Saf, and next week, we take up explanation of Surah Jum'ah. God bless you, and goodbye.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has been accused of a cover-up during the time that they were involved in the Afghanistan war. A new inquiry launched into how the SAS soldiers killed Afghan civilians dated back to the year 2010. Now, what is worse is that this involves more than 50 summary killings by the SAS soldiers. And even worse yet, it came when for years there were reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood, which meant that they were aware of it, authorities higher up. Why was this covered up is the first question, and more importantly, why would the British soldiers do that? Were there orders from the top down? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Rahiz, I'll first start with you. So we have the nature of the crime, as it's been said, which is much more extensive than this, but this is an inquiry that's being held again on more than 50, what we understand, summary killings by the SIA soldiers, 54, according to what has been revealed. And it happened in Helmand province between the years 2010 and 11, of which the conclusion was that this amounted to war crimes. What is your immediate reaction to this, something, again, that's been reopened to follow through in order to perhaps get some prosecution, if that is at all possible?
Firstly, I don't think there'll be any prosecutions whatsoever. If you consider that this is already a decade after these war crimes and murders, extrajudicial executions have been carried out, and it's only now that the second investigation is underway. The people in Afghanistan will never receive justice. The only justice they had was at the bayonet points of the British soldiers that had gone halfway around the world to oppress and subdue the Afghan people. I, as you introduced me, I live in Belfast in Ireland, and we all here know about British war crimes. In 1971, on the 9th of August, when the British reintroduced internment without trial, the British paratroopers run amok in Belfast on the 9th of August 1971 and murdered 11 people in what were called the Spring Hill Ballymurphy massacres. The inquests have only taken part last year, 50 years after those people were brutally cut down. People who were unarmed, including
Why does it take so long, though? Why does that take that long for this to be even covered and then, you know, perhaps, again, with, as you said, no prosecution to take place?
Well, it's part of the cover-up. You see, if you don't have an inquest, then there's no accountability as to how the people died. The British government and indeed the British Army claimed that these people were armed, that these were terrorists, that these were insurrectionists, people who died in gun battles, which is all lies, and it's all propaganda and it's all cover-up. And in fact, 6 months after these murders in Belfast, we had 13 unarmed civil rights protesters murdered in Derry on what was called Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January. Right. 1972. And the gentleman who was in charge of that was then later went on to become the general officer commanding of British Land Forces. A soldier one day becomes the general officer commanding several years later after committing war crimes in the streets of Derry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start out with a general description of a couple of the, first the general, overview, Robert Fantina, of what was disclosed, and then we're going to get into a couple cases, if not three, if we have the time, of the nature of the crimes that were committed, because that needs to be unfortunately or fortunately reviewed here so that you can grasp the gravity of the crime that was committed. First, in terms of the overall view, from the evidence and disclosures required by the court, it says that the Afghan man detained by these SAS soldiers were during night raids, and they were often separated from their families, and they were shot dead. This was routine, where the troops then went and planted weapons on them to justify the crimes. So that's an overall view of what happened. The question is, why would they subscribe, these SA soldiers, to such a method?
There are a few reasons. One is that they were given orders by their superiors and supervisors to do this, to terrorize the population by killing the men in their, or pulling them out of their homes and killing them. So terrorize the population to subdue them and prevent any kind of resistance to the invading forces was could have been ordered by their leaders. The other reason is simply that these soldiers, many soldiers in the United States, UK, and other places, are trained to kill. That is what they do. That is their job. And so they see anybody and they will kill them. They also, there is discrimination against the people of Afghan. Afghanistan is not a Christian country. It's mainly a Muslim country. And in the West, Muslims are seen as different and dangerous. And so the soldiers who are accused of killing, who allegedly killed these civilians, were probably part of or felt that same way, that these people weren't worthy of life the same way as they were, and therefore they were free to kill them. Now, this is what we see in war frequently, so it's nothing new. The fact that it's been exposed or it's being investigated after all these years simply tells us that the British government doesn't take it all that seriously.
Well, let's take a look at a more graphic example here. And I'm sorry if it bothers you. I do apologize right now. But Fra Hughes, I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways, because this is one of the things that is pretty much an eye-opener, where you have an instance of two Afghan children where it is, again, citing this source, at 8 p.m., you have the British and Afghan soldiers. They burst into a home, a 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old who were staying there overnight were taken, and a witness said, "When I entered the room afterwards, I saw bones and teeth all over the place. There were four altogether. The four of them were lying there, blood everywhere." Is that what SAS soldiers are trained to do?
I think brutality goes along with the mindset of people who are trained, specifically these special air service personnel. They're trained not to take prisoners. They're trained to torture people. They're trained to gather information, and they're trained to terrorize the local population. I mean, you don't have to go any further than, was it Abu Ghraib? When you see what happened in the prison with the torture, you know, with prisoners that were naked, that were attacked by dogs, the dehumanization of other races and other religions and other nations is part and parcel of like Western imperialism. So, you know, the brutality, there'd be nobody held to account, and these people will just basically get away with murder. And the victims and their families will never get any closure. And, you know, let's not forget what's happening in Yemen. Let's not forget what's happening in Syria and in Libya. This is happening all over West Asia and further afield.
Sure.
And the brutality that we've witnessed in Ukraine as well from the fascists there. It's a mindset, and unfortunately, no one's held to account.
You mentioned a very key phrase there, Robert Frentina, and you said that this may be, or that this is, how orders have been handed from the top down, which is why it's executed by these special soldiers. And I found a sentence where it's interesting, where it said that it's the sort of violence that occurs in a war where brutality is encouraged from the top down. And then it went on to say Britain's whole occupation is built on it. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Britain has a long history as a colonial nation, over 100 years, and throughout its that colonial history, it's been very violent. Look at what the British did in India and other places. So violence is always part of war. It's always part of colonialism and occupation. We can look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians and have been for decades now. Violent, oppressive, cruel, really inhumane. And these are the components of war and of occupation. They simply come with the territory, and they are all criminal. They're all crimes against humanity. They're all war crimes, but countries, governments continue to perpetrate them, or perpetuate them, I should say, and we don't see them being held to account in really any circumstances whatsoever.
This not being held to account is what the problem is, which I believe leads to, if you agree, Fra Hughes, to this being committed on a repeated case. I mean, when you take a look at what has been revealed, where the UK was aware for years about these SAS soldiers and they're basically committing war crimes, but criminal investigations were closed without any prosecutions to be brought forward, then that kind of is a green light for them to continue it in any other war scenario or any other scenario. It may not even involve a war scenario. Why would years of reports actually not be investigated, do you think?
Well, I think there's several parts to this, and one of them would be that the British government does not want the British people to know what's being done in their name by their army and by their special air services. And the other one is, we in the north of Ireland have gone through our own kind of post-conflict amnesty. The British government last year actually brought into, or is bringing onto the statute books, a law that would give amnesty to war crimes carried out by British personnel over the 30 years of the conflict here in the north of Ireland. And it's been suggested that the amnesty would be more wide-ranging than the amnesty that was offered by Pinochet to cover human rights violations in Chile when he was in charge. And Queen's University in Belfast and the Committee for the Administration of Justice have both said that this amnesty proposed by the British government on behalf of the British armed forces would go much further than another 300 post-conflict amnesties. So what we have is not only no accountability and British soldiers being above the law, but now the law is going to be changed in order to protect them from war crimes. And if I was in Afghanistan, I would actually be bringing cases before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in The Hague, rather than try and get justice from the British government when none will be forthcoming.
Well, we have a situation here, Robert Fentanyl, where it's pretty interesting. You have the UK Ministry of Defence that created what was called the and I'm going to move to another war scenario, and it's called the other war that the UK was involved in, which was based on the false premise of supposed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which that never turned out to be the case. They actually created a ministry called the Iraq, not a ministry, but a team called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, where it looked into accusations of abuse committed by the British in Iraq now, between the years 2003 and 2006. And then they discovered some 280 victims of alleged unlawful killings and 1,235 cases of ill treatment, which included rape and torture. And then you have the government come up with a UK MP's committee, which said, you know what, that's not true, that can't be right. And they said it's an unstoppable self-perpetuating machine, deaf to the concerns of the armed forces, and that it had to be shut down. How do you explain that?
This is only explained by the fact that the UK government, like many or most other governments, doesn't want to be constrained in any way by going to war wherever they choose to go. And as your other commentator mentioned, they want their people to think of the military and members of the military as noble and going around the world to help people. This, of course, is a huge lie and a complete myth. They don't want them to know the savagery that these soldiers commit on a regular basis. Now, the fact that the UK established a committee, identified war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then simply, with a stroke of a pen, voided those findings is beyond appalling. The innocent victims receive no closure, there can be no compensation for loss of life. Nothing will compensate for that. But there's no accountability, and this just leaves the military, it gives the military free rein to commit whatever crimes it wants to in the future. So soldiers know from this that anything they do, they will not be held accountable for, and there's no limit to the cruelty they can inflict on their victims.
So let's take a look at some of the wars, and let's pick the two that really stands out, I think, for our Hughes, and the one in Afghanistan, obviously, and then, of course, the Iraq War. If you were to take a look at the way that the countries involved and their soldiers, how they acted in such a way, and I'm not talking about all of them, but obviously a portion of them that acted in the way that they did, where obviously violations of human rights was taking place at a minimum based on some of the ruling acts that have taken place, and I'm being very soft on calling it a violation of human rights. Didn't that contribute to the war itself to be lost and for there not to be a success, particularly, for example, when you take a look at Afghanistan, 20 years there, and you had UK soldiers, you had soldiers from ISAF, you had US soldiers, but they didn't, as the one general once said, they wanted to win the hearts and minds, and they didn't. I believe it was the former General Flynn. It's because of these types of acts. Wasn't that a contributory to them not winning the war overall?
Yes, they used violent repression in order to stop resistance. So what they've done is they've invaded against the will of the Afghan and Iraqi people. The people have reacted and resisted this foreign military intervention and occupation. And in order to stop and try to prevent the resistance, then they bring about more repression, more fear, more murders, more torture, more violence. And the more that they use that, the more people react. If you kill someone in cold blood who's innocent and unarmed, their brother, their friend, their son, it's not about revenge. People will just at some point say, this is not acceptable. And in order to stop this, we must make these foreign invaders leave our country. But the fact is that Britain and America and the other people involved in this, they tried hearts and minds here in Ireland as well. It's nothing more than propaganda, giving sweets to children, visiting people in hospital, trying to bring aid and succor and comfort to people in small communities. It's all PR. It's all propaganda. It's all a manipulation of the reality of what's happening on the ground. And, you know, from the day in our, any colonial power goes in and occupies any sovereign nation, there will always be resistance, and that resistance normally always wins. It's just a matter of time, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in the case of Ireland, 800 years. But eventually, sure, people will fight and receive their freedom.
Indeed. Well, you have instances where Robert Fintina, you have the accusations and then the proof that is out there, but yet the governments, the respective governments, don't want to follow through with the prosecution. In the case of the UK, since we've put some focus on that, even the ICC Court at The Hague has said hundreds of Iraqis, in terms of their testimonies, showed a pattern of beatings, sleep and sensory deprivation, stress positions, deprivation of food and water, sexual and religious humiliation, and what have you. Kind of sounds like a rap sheet for the American soldiers in Abu Ghraib and what they did there. So when this happens and so much time has gone by, doesn't this mean when the prosecutions are not there that there's a flaw in the system and that needs to be rectified? But then who do you go to do that? Because obviously these soldiers or whoever that's committing these war crimes are, they're immune to it. They're being shielded by the governments.
It's not a flaw in the system. The system is working the way the governments want it to work. They want to avoid and evade, push out the timeline investigation. Hopefully people forget. Hopefully the stories will, and then they can sweep these atrocities under the rug and commit them again. Now, these new investigation that has launched is in early next year, will be probably another show, some testimony given, some witnesses, and then minor findings may be determined or decided upon that there were some abuses here and there, but nothing that was typical. And then there might be one or two soldiers getting a slap on the wrist. But the people who are really responsible, the lead, held accountable, and they will be free, commit these crimes against humanity again and again and again, simply because, as I said, this is the way for the governments. They want this free reign to do whatever they choose in whenever they're involved in a foreign invasion, and holding people accountable for their crimes against humanity would constrain them. It's as it should work, but it's not how the governments want it to work, so they have set up the system so that there will be no accountability.
Sure. Well, I can't help but look back as our guest there was talking, Frahiz, and get your thoughts on what was called the Chilcot Inquiry, where you had the case of this, as I mentioned before, in terms of the false notion of WMDs in Iraq, and yet you have the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair or the former US President George Bush Jr. who have walked scot-free, and they've been responsible for so many deaths And still, the remnants of that war are echoing in the hospital chambers of people who are suffering from nuclear remnants from ammunition that was used, that was tainted with nuclear material. I mean, it's just something not right about this.
Yes, you're probably referring to the massacre in Fallujah where they used depleted uranium. I mean, Tony Blair, in my mind, he's a war criminal, and so is Bush. And all the deaths that occurred are all about foreign Western corporations going in and taking oil and gas and gold and whatever else it is that they took. And in Iraq, didn't they take millions, if not billions, of gold, pounds worth and dollars worth of gold bars that were that were in Iraq? And then on top of that, we can see through all this pain that still continues today. I mean, there are still landmines. There are still people losing their legs on a frequent basis in these countries from all the landmines that have been kind of abandoned all over the country in order to inflict further pain and torment kind of post-conflict after the war has been resolved. But there weren't only, you know, victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned the Chilcot report, and it made me think straight away of David Kelly. David Kelly was the British scientist who was claimed to have sexed up the dossier in order to make it appear that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the excuse used for the war. He walked off out into the woods near his home and didn't come back. They said he committed suicide. But in the film, The Killing of Kelly by George Galloway, there are persistent rumours that he was murdered. So the British government didn't just murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan. They quite possibly murdered a British scientist in order to cover up what he might have told any future inquiry as to how they came about with this whole notion of the weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantina, author and journalist. Farah Hughes, thank you so much. Journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do.
Ya Rasulallah.
I wanna walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you. Rasulullah.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of the program Like Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi from IRIB English Radio. In this program, as the name suggests, we try to have a close look at different aspects of the lifestyle of our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa